There's a flower that once fed Neolithic farmers and later fueled the most powerful drug empire in history. It soothed gods in ancient Egypt, inspired the dreams of romantic poets, and bankrolled wars that changed global order. Today, it's at the root of the most lethal overdose crisis on Earth, and yet, you can still grow it legally in your backyard. Papaver cinerifolium, the opium poppy, is a plant of contradiction. On one hand, its history is full of fervor and scandal. On the other hand, it's a staple in muffin recipes. Also, it's probably the prettiest Schedule II controlled substance we have. I'm Megan Bram, and in this episode of The History of Plants, we'll trace how this unassuming flower went from food to medicine to weapon, how it reshaped nations, rewired brains, and redefined what it means to chase relief. Part 1, an ancient flower. There's a reason Papaver cinerifolium keeps showing up in tombs, temples, and jars with opium residue. Archaeologically speaking, this plant has been part of our story for a very long time. The earliest confirmed cultivation goes back over 7,000 years, with waterlogged seeds recovered from Neolithic sites in Switzerland, Italy, and Spain. These weren't wild samples tucked away by foragers. Morphometric studies showed the seeds were already changing shape, evolving under human influence to be larger and more chemically potent. Genomic analysis now points to its origin in the Western Mediterranean, where humans first domesticated it from its wild cousin, Papaver cinerifolium. From there, it spread east to the Aegean and Near East and eventually south into Egypt. There's long been a theory that the Sumerians were the first to cultivate the poppy, calling it Hugil, the joy plant. But archaeobotanical evidence leans towards Egypt and the Aegean getting there first. In Egypt, the Ebers Papyrus, which was written around 1550 BCE and is considered the earliest surviving medical text we have, contains what's likely the first recorded reference to the opium poppy. While the plant isn't named directly as Papaver cinerifolium, many scholars believe a substance called shepin refers to an opium-based preparation. It was used as a soporific, a substance that dulls pain and induces sleep, and was prescribed for everything from headaches to colicky infants. In a culture where medicine, ritual, and spirituality were inseparable, healing plants held divine associations. And while we don't have definitive proof, several Egyptian deities have been loosely linked to opium's use in healing. Tot, the god of wisdom and medicine, was often invoked at the start of medical texts. Sekhmet, goddess of both plague and healing, had a priesthood deeply involved in early medicine. And Isis, who was said to know every herb on earth, appears frequently in magical medical spells. None of these are directly tied to poppy, let me be clear about that. But given the plant's known properties and ritual importance, it's easy to imagine it was within their domains. In Greece, we see the first push and pull for the poppy's efficacy and usefulness. Hippocrates used opium cautiously, employing poppy-based preparations for pain and sleep, but sparingly, in line with his broader philosophy of balance and treatment. Still, it found its way into two legendary formulas, Mithridatum and Theriact, which were compounded antidotes that aimed to protect against any poison. These pharmacological catch-alls became staples in elite medicine for centuries, evolving through the Roman Empire and into Renaissance Europe. And at the heart of both? Opium. By the 1st century CE, Dioscorides described the poppy in his 5-volume De Materia Medica, the most influential medical reference in the Western world for over a millennium, copied, translated, and studied well into the Renaissance. He listed it as both a gift and a hazard, noting that its dried latex, quote, puts men to sleep and may kill them outright in higher doses. About a century later, Galen expanded on that reputation. He championed opium as a near-universal remedy for insomnia, pain, digestive issues, and even sadness, but he also understood its risks, overdose, dependency, and death. In the wrong hands, opium could be a quiet poison, but in a world with no anesthesia or antidepressants, it was a hard plant to ignore, especially when it can make suffering quieter. For thousands of years, the poppy was just that. It was a medicine, crushed into salves, steeped into potions, or offered in rituals. But eventually, it got pulled into something bigger, because empires noticed and economies took root. And that flower that once soothed infants would soon bankroll invasions, redraw borders, and leave a legacy of addiction in its wake. Part 2, a plant of empires. For so long, opium had been a healer. It was a tool of medicine, of ritual, and occasionally as a quiet poison. But as global trade expanded and colonial powers chased profit across continents, the poppy's role began to shift. By the 1500s, European physicians were turning to opium regularly. In England, a new tincture called laudanum, a mix of alcohol and opium, was becoming a staple in apothecaries. It was used to ease everything from coughs to grief, and by the 17th century, it was nearly in every medicine cabinet in Britain. And it wasn't just physicians who took notice. British Romantic writers turned to laudanum not only for relief, but for revelation. Samuel Taylor Coleridge famously claimed that his dreamlike poem Kubla Khan came to him during an opium-induced trance. Thomas de Quincey, in his 1821 Confessions of an English Opium Eater, chronicled the euphoria, nightmares, and slow unraveling that came with dependence. For poets like Coleridge, Byron, and even Percy Shelley, opium wasn't just a medicine. It was a muse, one that offered visions in exchange for a very steep cost. So by the time the British Empire turned its gaze eastward, it already knew poppy's power. And that's where China enters the story, and with it, one of the most infamous trade sagas in botanical history. As we mentioned in our History of Tea episode, Britain had developed a national obsession with Chinese tea, importing shiploads of it to fuel everything from genteel drawing rooms to industrial break rooms. And it wasn't just tea. Chinese silk and porcelain were just as coveted. But Britain had a problem. China wasn't at all interested in British goods. Textiles, clocks, ceramics, meh. China demanded silver in return, and Britain was bleeding bullion to keep the goods flowing. And that's when the East India Company, nominally separate from Parliament, but aligned in economic interest, decided it was time to play dirty. Because opium was a product they could grow cheaply in colonized Bengal and smuggle into China in vast quantities. It became more than a commodity. It became an addiction-powered trade equalizer, a narcotic that guaranteed both demand and dependence. But here's the thing. In Britain, opium-based products like laudanum were perfectly legal. You could walk into an apothecary and pick up a bottle for headaches, sleeplessness, or the nerves. Addiction existed, of course, but nothing close to the scale we're about to see. In China, opium was far more tightly controlled. Medicinal use remained legal in specific settings, but by the 1700s, recreational opium had taken hold across Chinese society. It became such a crisis that in 1729, the Yongzheng Emperor issued the first imperial edict banning recreational smoking and prohibiting trade and import for non-medicinal use. By the 1800s, the law went even further, fully banning foreign imports and domestic trafficking. But that didn't stop the trade. The British government, while not officially selling opium, allowed the East India Company to flood China with it. Fields of poppies in Bengal were processed into bricks of refined latex and then trafficked through an elaborate smuggling network. It was bureaucratic sleight of hand. Plausible deniability traded for a booming shadow economy. China had had enough. In 1839, Imperial Commissioner Lin Zexu seized and destroyed over 20,000 chests of British opium at Humen, a dramatic act of resistance against foreign influence and narcotic dependence. The British framed it as an affront to free trade and national honor. But let's be honest, what they really wanted were their cheap Chinese goods, and the idea that anyone, especially a non-European power, would dare to challenge the reach of the British Empire, that would not stand. On September 4th, 1839, the First Opium War began, marking a turning point for the Qing military. For centuries, China's dynastic force that had dominated East Asia, defending borders, suppressing uprisings, and projecting stability across a really immense empire. But now, they were facing a modernized British Navy with ironclad ships, explosive artillery, and a ruthless mandate to protect trade profits. It didn't go well for China. On August 29, 1842, the Treaty of Nanking was signed, marking the end of the First Opium War. China was forced to cede Hong Kong, abolish the centuries-old Canton trading system, and open five major ports, including Shanghai and Guangzhou, to British merchants. But the financial terms were just as punishing. The Qing government had to pay over 21 million silver dollars, roughly 560 million pounds sterling, or 749 million US dollars today. That included 6 million to compensate Britain for the opium destroyed by Lin Zexu, 3 million to cover debts owed by Chinese merchants in Canton, and 12 million for war reparations. Payments were to be made in installments over 3 years with 5% annual interest charged on any late payments. Britain also secured most favored nation status, meaning any concessions China made to other countries would automatically apply to them. It was a lopsided deal by any measure, and one that left China nursing a deep sense of injustice. Less than two decades later, those wounds would erupt into war yet again. On October 8, 1856, Qing officials boarded a ship called the Arrow and arrested its Chinese crew on suspicion of piracy. The Arrow's registration had technically expired, but Britain seized the opportunity and claimed the move violated its sovereignty. Britain gunboats fired on Canton the next day. France soon joined the fray, citing the murder of a French missionary in Guangxi. And just like that, the Second Opium War had begun, this time with two Western powers bearing down on China. The joint British-French forces quickly escalated. They captured Canton, detained the viceroy of Liangguang, Ye Mingchen, and in June 1858, forced the Qing court into signing the Treaty of Tianjin. It expanded trade rights, opened China's interior to missionaries, allowed foreign diplomats in Beijing, and perhaps most devastatingly, legalized the opium trade. But the ink barely dried before the emperor refused to ratify it, and that refusal reignited the war. And this time, the West came back with a vengeance. In 1860, as Allied troops marched toward Beijing, British envoy Harry Parkes and several others were taken hostage. Some were tortured and some were killed. In retaliation, Lord Elgin ordered the destruction of the Old Summer Palace, a cultural trove of art, architecture, and centuries of imperial history. Its ruins still stand today. This move was so drastic that it caused an uproar of public protests, even in the West. The Times of London called it, quote, a lamentable display of brute force over culture. Faced with overwhelming firepower, the Qing relented. In October 1860, they signed the Convention of Peking, ratifying the Treaty of Tientsin and ceding even more ground, including the Kowloon Peninsula, now part of Hong Kong. Meanwhile, Russia took the opportunity to strike its own deals, quietly annexing over 1.5 million square kilometers of Qing territory to the north and west. And if stories like this, where a single plant can shift the fate of nations, fascinate you, welcome to Plantrums, because that's what we do here, so don't forget to subscribe. And with that, opium wasn't just a product anymore. It was the currency of coercion, woven into treaties, traded for territory, and used as leverage to pry open the gates of empire. But what gave it that kind of power? Part 3, chemistry of control. The opium poppy didn't conquer the world on charm alone. Its true power comes from its chemistry, which is a potent blend of alkaloids that could ease suffering, hijack the brain, and keep the masses hooked. What empires traded in bricks and treaties, the poppy delivered in molecules. At the heart of Papaver sonniferum is a milky latex, one that contains over 50 alkaloids. But three stand out: morphine, codeine, and thebaine. Once ingested or inhaled, morphine binds to the brain's mu opioid receptors, triggering a flood of dopamine. It dulls pain, slows breathing, wraps the mind in that warm, hazy blanket people have been describing for millennia. Codeine acts more gently. It's a milder analgesic and cough suppressant often used in over-the-counter medications. Thebaine, on the other hand, is chemically unstable and not used directly, but is the precursor for synthetic opioids like oxycodone and buprenorphine. The result? Euphoria, sedation, and eventually dependence. And that's exactly what made it irresistible. In the early 1800s, chemists scrambled to isolate these compounds. A German pharmacist named Friedrich Zürtürner succeeded first. In 1804, he crystallized morphine from raw opium, testing it on himself and a few unlucky neighborhood dogs. The effects were conclusive. By the mid-19th century, morphine was mass-produced and celebrated as a medical miracle. It was used in battlefield surgeries, chronic pain treatments, and even children's cough syrups. Its addictive potential wasn't a footnote, it was practically the feature. Patients would keep coming back even when their original illness had long resolved. And then in 1853, the hypodermic needle was invented, giving morphine a direct route into the bloodstream. Now, since it didn't need to pass through the stomach, morphine hit faster, harder, and more efficiently. Use skyrocketed. After the American Civil War, so many veterans became dependent on morphine that the condition earned the nickname the soldier's disease. Meanwhile, pharmaceutical chemists kept pushing. In 1874, C.R. Alder Wright, an English chemist, synthesized diacetylmorphine, a modified version of morphine designed to be less addictive. Spoiler, it wasn't. But that didn't stop Bayer Pharmaceuticals, which began marketing it in 1898 under a more consumer-friendly name, heroin. Heroin was sold as a safe, non-addictive substitute for morphine. Even children's cough syrups included it, and it took years and a wave of dependency before regulators stepped in. But by then, the damage was done, and all of it traces back to the single flower. A plant that didn't just numb pain, it redefined how we treated it. One that shaped medicine, warfare, and eventually policy. Because when nature builds something that powerful, humans don't just admire it, we weaponize it. Part 4, the global poppy effect. Even after the treaties were signed and the palaces burned, Papaver sonniferum didn't fade quietly into the background. The world had gotten a taste, and it wanted more. In the early 20th century, countries started to recognize just how deep the addiction went. Morphine, heroin, opium tinctures, they were everywhere. Pain management had become chemical and the consequences were piling up. So governments did what governments do. They tried to regulate. In 1912, the Hague Opium Convention was the first international treaty aimed at controlling narcotics. In the U.S., the Harrison Narcotics Tax Act of 1914 required strict documentation for the sale and distribution of opiates. But the poppy was always one step ahead. Even as countries tried to lock down medical access, illicit networks flourished. Farmers in the Golden Triangle, where the borders of Myanmar, Laos, and Thailand blur into one mountainous hub, began cultivating poppy en masse. The same happened in Afghanistan, where where unstable governments and a lack of economic alternatives meant poppy became one of the few viable cash crops. But cultivation comes at a cost. In Southeast Asia, slash-and-burn techniques used to clear forest for poppy fields caused widespread deforestation. In Mexico, the push for heroin production led to aggressive expansion into protected ecosystems. Poppies may look delicate, but their global footprint is anything but. Entire landscapes have been reshaped, soil been depleted, water diverted, and biodiversity lost, all in pursuit of a plant that seduces with its alkaloids. Meanwhile, poppy's chemistry kept evolving. By the 1980s and 90s, pharmaceutical companies, particularly in the U.S., were synthesizing new opioids from poppy derivatives. Oxycodone, which was derived from thebaine, hit the market as a so-called safe painkiller. You probably know where this is going. The opioid epidemic exploded, and while today's synthetic drugs like fentanyl often bypass the flower entirely, they wouldn't exist without the template the opium poppy provided. So governments cracked down harder. More regulations, more surveillance, more eradication campaigns, often backed by the United Nations or U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. In theory, these programs were meant to reduce supply and encourage farmers to switch to legal crops, but in practice, they often just devastated rural economies and fueled resentment. Because when you rip out a farmer's only means of survival without offering a viable alternative, what do you expect them to do? And to add yet another layer of mess, some of these very regions targeted for eradication were also sites of foreign military intervention. So the war on drugs blurred into other wars, on terror, on poverty, on dissent, you name it. Today, the conversation has shifted yet again. We talk more about harm reduction, safe consumption sites, and destigmatizing addiction, but regulation still lags behind need. In some countries, morphine access for terminal cancer patients is nearly non-existent due to fear of misuse. In others, heroin is handled out in supervised clinics. It's a paradox that stems from the same source. One flower, two paths, relief or ruin. Part 5, Legacy and Bloom. Today, the opium poppy is still grown legally in carefully monitored fields across countries like Australia, Turkey, and India, to name a few. Also, if you're curious, yes, in many countries, it's legal to grow this flower in your backyard, but it is very illegal to harvest its opium. So maybe stick to the muffins. And unlike the shadowy trade routes of the past, today's poppies are tracked, traced, and harvested for pharmaceutical use. Their alkaloids still form the backbone of essential medications, from post-op painkillers to end-of-life care. But look, we can't discount the shadow it casts. Entire generations have been lost to addiction, some from black market heroin, others from overprescribed pills, all stemming from the same flower that's carefully cultivated in sterile fields to ease the suffering of hospice patients, to sedate children in trauma wards, to numb agony when there's no other drug that will do. It is a contradiction rooted in the plant's biology, and it raises a bigger question. When a single species can cradle both compassion and catastrophe in its petals, how do we hold that legacy? Some see it as a cautionary tale. It's like a botanical Icarus whose flight took us too close to comfort. Others call it an essential tool in medicine. And maybe that's the point. If you think about it, maybe the opium poppy isn't just a plant. Maybe it's kind of like a mirror, reflecting what we choose to amplify, healing or harm. Relief or dependence, care or control. I'm Megan Brain. Thank you for joining me on another episode of The History of Plants. You can jump into the Patreon to check out my commentary on this episode, or if you want to learn about another plant that blurs the line between medicine, poison, and power, check out our episode on henbane, a plant used by witches, warriors, and wandering husbands. Until next time, greenies, stay curious, and don't forget to flourish.